This is Jonathan Mickles with the Strategic Multifamily Investing Podcast. And today I have with me Mr. Paul Thompson. How's it going, Paul?
It's going great. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to having a conversation.
Absolutely. And again, thank you again for you and your team and working through schedules. I know it was a little while for us to get there. So,
Yeah, we're all just making it happen, aren't we?
absolutely, my friend. Absolutely. So you are in real estate and you started off in residential, right?
Yes, that's where I first cut my teeth, was in residential single family. It was the lowest barrier to entry thing that I knew to get into. And as I grew in sophistication, I realized that a multifamily was a better way to grow your real estate empire, so to speak, faster because of the economies of scale. But it took me a little while to get there, and I kind of cut my teeth in my own market here in Little Rock, Arkansas, buying a single family.
Cool. So then were you influenced? Was it always something that somebody in the family wanted to get into real estate? Did you read a book? I mean, what was it that, like, you know, this?
What got me started? Well, the reason I got started in real estate is because I wanted a way to replace my day job. I had a professional corporate America type, white collar type job, and it was not all that bad of a life, but if I stopped going, then they stopped paying me. And I was a single income family, and so I was nervous about if something ever happened to me getting laid off, then I wouldn't be able to make ends meet without having to relocate my family. And so I just felt super vulnerable. And I actually had this really big wake-up call moment when I was on a beach vacation in the year 2014, I believe it was. And I was on a beach vacation and I had an opportunity to extend my vacation another week because where we were staying became available, kind of a fluke situation. And my kids were like, "Hey, can we stay longer?" I was like, "I think it's a great idea. My wife wanted to do it." She was a stay-at-home mom, so her schedule was free. My kids were out of school for the summer vacation. They were free, but I had a job to go back to. But I worked in telecommunications. Like, we made the technology which makes this thing of Zoom possible, right? Like, so even in 2014, that wasn't that much of a stretch. All the people who worked for me, like, they lived all over the country. So it wasn't like I really had to be in button seat situation. So I called my boss up and said, "Hey, I'm looking to extend my vacation. I'm going to work my normal hours. You won't know anything's different, but I'm just going to have this chance to stay at the beach, and the family will go and do their thing during the day. And then I'll join them in the evening when my normal shift is over." He says, "Oh, no, we don't do that here. Like, I expect you back in the office Monday at 8 o'clock, click."
Wow. Okay.
It wasn't even a conversation, right? It was just like, it was just, "We don't do that here."
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. So,
So I tucked my tail between my legs and drove home. What else was I to do? Because I needed that job more than they needed me. And that was kind of my moment that was like, okay, like, I'm not as important to this company as I thought I was. And I was kind of middle management. And I figured at any point in my career, the likelihood of me getting laid off was pretty high. Because the cold equations of corporate America just sets it up so that you're just not going to you're going to be replaced somehow. Just corporate politics gets in the way.
That's
and
it.
I was vulnerable, and that's the reason I started looking for an alternative way to make income.
Got it. So then let me ask this question. Now that you said, okay, real estate is going to be the way, because it could have been stocks, bonds, it could have been, you know, trading and things of that sort. You mentioned that you were a single income household. I mean, where were you at this point in time with your wife and her thoughts about this? Because, you know, I know that there are a lot of people who, you know, are looking to make this venture and they're a little nervous and, you know, they have a spouse and, you know, it can be a little bit of tension there. What, how did you navigate those waters, if you don't mind me asking that?
Sure. That's a good question to consider. You know, what does your life partner think about your new venture? And in our case, what we did is I kept working, and then I worked at finding real estate properties on the side. So it was kind of like my side hustle for a while. And I built a 3-year plan thinking that if I bought this many properties and made this much cash flow, I'd be able to replace my day job. And it turns out that 2 years into that 3-year plan, my company came through and laid me off. And so when I got that message, I wasn't completely surprised, but I was not expecting it.
Right.
So of course, the first person I called was my wife, and was like, "As it turns out, I'm not actually employed anymore as of this moment." And she said, and her words were, "Well, you've been planning for this. It's going to be all right." And thank goodness I had been planning for
You got a great spouse, great spouse.
it. I mean, she was nervous, don't get me wrong. It's like, I mean, there's, we all have expenses that we want to cover for, and we're raising kids and whatnot. And it's, I think, just a really stark reminder for everybody listening to this that you always need to be working on building equity in your life. Whether that's buying stocks or buying real estate or building your own business, you need to buy, build, or create equity in something that you own and you control so that somebody else can't come through and let you off.
So is your wife now also involved in real estate, or is she just still working, primarily to take care of the family?
Good question. So our kids are a little older now. At the time when this all happened, my kids were, much younger. They were, grade school age, and now they're in junior high and high school. And, so the responsibilities there aren't as much. So my wife has gotten a little more involved in some midterm rentals that we own. So it's like 30-day stay type of vacation rentals, or short term or midterm rentals, you might call them. And so traveling nurses, vacation for traveling professionals typically is who we focus that towards. And she likes to decorate and make sure that the properties are turned over properly, because in a lot of cases somebody's lived there for 3 to 6 months, and so there's a little bit of repairs and we have to kind of restock things, and she really enjoys that process. So
Cool.
she's involved a little bit in that regard.
So then let's talk about, before we move on to the multifamily, because I ultimately want to get there. And, I know that you
Sure.
have a specific expertise, but you mentioned midterm rentals versus, say, long-term rentals, and buy and
Right.
holds. What was the decision there? I mean, did you use the burr move, move, thought, and then say, I'm going to take these and make these midterm because I'll get a, what was your thought there?
Well, I wanted to take my existing properties and see if I could juice the returns. And so 3 or 4 years ago, I guess when they made this point, 2 or 3 years ago, during the pandemic, shortly after the pandemic, the interest rates increased, and it was just harder to find properties and find your own native deals. And I thought, well, I have some properties that would work really well as a midterm rental. I didn't really want to get into the short-term vacation rental space because there's just a lot of management to it. There's a lot of additional income possibilities, but I wasn't sure I was ready to sign up for that level of work. So I thought, let's just run an experiment. Let's take one of my properties. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, and let's turn it into a midterm rental. We spent about $15,000 to get it furnished, and we factored in that we thought we could get that back in about a year's time with extra revenue. And so as about now, we're about a year and a half into it, and we've paid that all back, and now we're just getting extra. So we're getting about 1.5 times the net income, or I guess 1.5 times the to 2 times the revenue, and perhaps 2 to 3 times the net income we would if we were just to rent that long term.
Okay, so then you're using something like Furnished Finder, or you're reaching out to the locum tenens office directly.
Good question. So we have looked into Furnish Finder, but we haven't yet listed our property there. We have found Airbnb is the more effective rate or effective way because they just have more eyeballs. And I'm always a little bit nervous with Airbnb because, they kind of rule the roost, like their rules apply and no matter what, but they just have so many eyeballs that it's so effective at bringing quality tenants that we get a chance to screen, and we require them to do a background check, and then or we have their employer's background check work in lieu of that, which we find typically is a pretty good solution.
So you do a, there's an employer's background check that you can do on Airbnb? I didn't know that.
No, what I mean is, when someone finds your property in Airbnb, they say, "Hey, I'm staying there for 30 days or longer. I'm a nurse, or I'm in the military." Like their background check, basically a work contract, is proof enough to us that they're probably going to be a good renter because they've gone through their employer's background check.
Got it. So then you require the, that contract so that you can see
Right.
that they actually have that. Okay, great. I understand. And just, for everybody else who's listening in on the conversation, I know that some people who do medium rentals are looking for travel nurses, and I think Furnished
Yes.
Finder has a traveling nurses subsite, if you're
They
interested in
do.
doing
It's called like travelingnurses.com or something like that. Yeah.
it. There you
Yeah.
go. And essentially, a lot of the locum tenens, because that's what the it's called. It's Latin. Locum tenens are for temporary, like assignments for doctors and
Right.
nurses in hospitals. And so there's oftentimes a department there that you can reach out to. But a lot of times they, go out to national organizations, and those national
Yeah.
organizations go to Furnish Finder, and there you go. You can find them that way. So just throwing it out there for anybody else who's interested in
Yep.
medium
Nice
term.
tidbit, isn't it?
It is. Medium-term rentals. So in terms of you, how long were you in the residential before you decided to go to commercial?
So probably about three, four years, I did single family only, and I did about every permutation of single family you can think of, with the exception of perhaps short-term vacation rentals. And I started buying smaller apartment complexes here in my
Okay.
market. And then I've since kind of branched out,
What's
and I do a go ahead.
when you say smaller apartment buildings, are we talking like they're quads and below, or are you going a little bit
Yeah.
higher than that?
I've got a couple of duplexes, but like a six unit, there's a couple of little
Okay.
places like that I've found. And so typically the lessons you learn on a six unit generally apply to, a larger apartment complex. There's only a few subtle differences. So the principles pretty much apply there. And you're having to qualify for a different type of loan, typically for a commercial grade loan for these, five unit or higher. And it's just a little bit different way that you build your financing, but it's just so much more scalable.
So then let's go back to, okay, you lost your job, right? And it was 2.5 years into your 3-year plan, and you had been planning for it. Did you find another job, or did you just launch straight into that and you started finding partners to help you to, with the additional things, or how did that work out?
So when I was laid off from my job, I had enough rental income to cover my basic living expenses. It wasn't enough to do anything extra, but it was enough. And but I had time all of a sudden. So now I use that extra time, and I picked up a few coaching clients, people who were asking me how I built that
Wow.
portfolio. So that
There you go.
supplemented my income a little bit. And then I spent more of my time actively looking for deals, wholesaling deals, and then doing some flips. And that got me enough experience in the marketing world that I could kind of cherry pick the best deals I was marketing for, and then assign a few properties, and then the ones that made more sense to flip, I would flip those. And then I just kind of made a business out of taking any given project that came to me. It's like, how can I best monetize this for my person? I used to refer to it as like three to thrive. So I would have three deals a month, and I could keep one as a rental, I could flip one, and I can assign one. And that would comfortably cover kind of all the bases that I needed in my life. And then over time, I just started doing more than three deals per month until such time that I just got completely burnt out with the whole marketing angle. But I had built up enough properties to where I could live off my rental income at that point.
So then, in terms of the 6 units and those smaller multifamilies that you got into, was it just you who was financing them, or did you start looking at partners at that time? Just.
Good question, because there is a point when you get into commercial real estate, multifamily, where you just pretty much have to partner. And unless you're just selling a property and having the proceeds pay for the next size up, that's another way to do it. But if you want to do it fast, then you're pretty much going to get a smaller piece of a bigger pie is the idea. And I've definitely gone into that. And so now what I do is I look at or look for sponsors. Instead of looking for deals now, I look for sponsors that know how to find quality deals. And then I partner with them, and I become a general partner, co-GP
Oh,
with
you want
them.
to
And
be a
I,
co-GP, not
yeah.
necessarily an LP. Okay.
I mean, I will be an LP when it makes sense, but I'll put some cash into the deal when it makes sense. But a lot of times, what I'm doing is I'm raising capital and doing the investor relations and making sure that all the K-1s are going out and doing kind of the paperwork side of things, whereas somebody else is doing the actual asset management and acquiring the property and negotiating the financing. So what I like about that is I can get, oftentimes it's like 1 to 5% ownership stake of a 300-unit apartment complex, but I don't have any kind of timely responsibilities other than making sure paperwork gets done.
Yeah,
So I'm
you're
able to
doing
hire a lot
quarterly.
of out.
Are you doing quarterly distributions, that kind of thing? Okay, so you don't have to really do very much hands-on day-to-day type things.
Yeah, and the intent is I can do that from anywhere. So I can be, anywhere I have access to the internet, I can plan ahead and make sure that whatever beach town I choose to be in at any given point. Not that I do that a ton, but I want that flexibility. That lifestyle design is really important to me. I'm not a property manager. I'm not an asset manager. I'm not boots on the ground for a project in very many cases at all.
So then that's something that you learned, some time ago. I mean, you got burnout from doing a lot of that marketing,
I
right?
did. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then you've had the hands-on and you recognize that's not where you want to be. So say somebody is out there listening right now and they say, look, I want to do exactly what you do. I want to do investor relations. I'm not going to say capital raise because
Right.
capital raise, with the SEC, because you're doing a lot of 506B offerings, correct?
Correct. Well, five. Yeah, I do both, and we can talk about that, what that means in a minute. But
Sure.
definitely finish your question.
Yeah, so if somebody is interested in doing what you do, let's work on the marketing, let's do investor relations.
Right.
How do they kind of get in there? And it's probably a good time to probably pause and talk about those 506 C's and
Yeah.
D,
Yeah, let's definitely put our disclaimers out there real quick that
Absolutely.
we're not attorneys, right?
Nope, not attorneys,
And we're not giving
not
tax
accountants.
advice.
Nope.
Yeah, right.
Nope.
And we're not giving any kind of investment advice.
No financial advisor. Yep.
But what we do is we go out there and look for deals. And we look for people who know how to find deals. And sometimes those people who know how to find deals need some help managing the entire business that it takes to run a large scale multifamily project. And so what Jonathan's talking about there, where he says like we can't really call ourselves capital raisers, is that unless you're a licensed person, you can't be compensated for just raising capital and then getting a share of the GP, right?
Correct.
That's not the way it you, the SEC doesn't like that, because that's
No.
basically you acting as a
Broker
as a
dealer.
licensed broker dealer when you're not licensed, right? And that's not what we are. What we are is we are business operators, and we provide value to a business. And one of those things that we do is acting as investor relations or property management or any other of the things that requires to run a project. But my specialty is not managing the asset. My specialty is managing the capital and the relationships that goes on behind the scenes. And there's a lot to it that a lot of people don't think about. That, and so long as I'm providing a material, and I have a voting share in the entity that we're co-GPing with, and like 51% or more of my activities is something other than raising capital, then I'm a legitimate member of that. And so 51% of my time is contributing more than just raising capital from other people. Then I'm a legitimate member of that entity, and I'm a sponsor of the project.
And just to go back for everybody else, may again, you may be brand new, and we throw out some terms of GP and LP. So GP stands for general partner.
Right.
General partners are the ones generally that are running the project from a day-to-day perspective, the property, et cetera. They're responsible for hiring the property managers, for actually managing the asset, making sure that it performs, and doing the investor relations, finding the deal, doing risk capital, all that stuff. And then there's the LP side. These are people who are a little bit more passive that says, hey, I've got some money over here. I'd like to put it, to usury, if you will. And, the two together make a wonderful blend. Now, you mentioned that you're not, you don't have an accounting background, I would assume. And so you're dealing with investor relations, and there's a ton of other things that are going on with that. I mean, how do you get around? Because you said there's a lot involved in that. How do you get around not being an accountant and then working with doing K-1s and making sure that those things go out? K-1s, again, are financial statements
Right.
that have to be filed with the IRS, with your taxes and things of that sort. So that's a responsibility of somebody, say, that would be in Paul's respon in Paul's chair. So how
Right.
did you train on that? What would you recommend for somebody who's potentially interested in doing this? Have in terms of skill set, et cetera, mindset.
Yeah, what's really interesting about the kind of investor relations role in these general partnerships is that you're not acting as the accountant or the, I mean, like you're not creating the K-1s. You're reviewing the K-1s to make sure that they align with the books that the company has been keeping. And then you share that to the investors. And then there's usually some sort of commentary or some sort of a communication as to what the business plan is and how it's performed based on what we've projected. And it's like kind of how is the strategy going? What's the market dynamics? And these are the things. It's really a communications role more so than it is an accounting role, because all I'm doing is reporting back to the investors on what the results have been, and here are the formal documents that kind of back up what we're saying. And that's what we spend our time doing. And so the way to kind of get that experience is to do your own projects at first. Like, I think it would be tough to step in as this role without having any assets under your belt at all, unless you had an accounting background or something. And so it's like, I'm an engineer, so numbers don't scare me, you know, running the numbers and that kind of thing. You know, running models is pretty comfortable to me. So I like to run the numbers, and I like to really understand the business plan. That's part of the value add that I bring to a general partner team when I'm part of it. And I like to do a lot of market research because I'm looking at it as an investment if I were an LP. And what would
There
I
you
want to
go.
see as an LP? That's a big part of it. And so then when you're basically reporting on an ongoing basis, you're reporting, keeping track of the business plan. And you're still on GP team meetings, and we're voting on behavior, and we're checking on KPIs, and we're running business meetings just like you would in any kind of business. It's just I'm not running in the operational role. I'm running in more of the financial role.
Gotcha. And so then with that, are you using, newsletter type applications, or are you using, because a lot of people have fundraising platforms, if you will. Is there one or some that you think are pretty decent that somebody who's beginning, this process, right? They may have their own assets. They can begin using something to help them to kind of understand what you're saying, if you will.
Yeah, so there are some common platforms that make this a lot easier. You don't have to use these, but they certainly help. And they're basically like portals. They're like software as a service subscriptions that you have. And there's, you know, Syndication Pro, Cashflow Portal, AppFolio. There's a number of them out there. And I would say my personal favorite is Cashflow Portal, but I have I'm members of GP teams that use Syndication Pro, and I've certainly seen AppFolio a lot. I don't think I'm actually a member of any of those right now. These are common platforms that keep all the documents in one place and give your limited partners, LP investors, a place to invest and kind of see the reports in a centralized place. And that's where they would upload their W-9s, and they would, you know, file the forms that they want to do to be compliant so that we can do all of our reporting correctly. And those software tools make what we're doing as a GP team much easier. I mean, they really streamline the process so that you can really focus on those relationships with your investors and with your vendors.
And a lot of those platforms also allow your investors to kind of self-serve themselves, right? There are a
A
lot of
lot.
documentation that they have to upload as well, and that you have to keep track of as investor relations. And so some of these portals allow all of that information to be for them to be able to upload it themselves. And then once they have gone in and you check the button, then and only then are they able to go in and,
Make the
potentially
investment.
why, make an investment, wire their funds, et cetera. So I know one, I forget which one it was, and I'm not sure if they still allow it, but they were free for any test deals.
Oh, cool.
So I forget which one that was. But essentially, like you said before, you do the numbers yourself. You do your own underwriting. And one of the things that I've heard other people say is to, create like a test deal. It's not an active deal. It's not something that you're showing, but it shows your chops, if you will, to be able to underwrite a deal. And if you have that on such of a platform, it will put you potentially in a position for other teams to be able to see exactly how you underwrite, number one. Number two, that you have the capacity to be able to manage that if you were brought on to do that. So that's something.
I
You
think it's a good
mentioned,
idea. I mean, the only
yeah.
distinction there is to make sure and always disclose. You know, you want to be careful not to promote a deal that wasn't real that you've been involved in. But it's certainly reasonable to set up a sample deal and use, you know, create your pitch deck and create your business model, and you can do this on real deals. You just may not be ones you actually purchase because we
Right.
all look at a lot of deals, and some of them pencil out. And are you making an offer that you think would pencil out, but the seller doesn't accept it? That still doesn't mean you can't run it through these tools to get familiar with them and kind of do a trial run so that when you do have a real deal, you're not surprised by what the requirements are.
Right. And you know how to use the tool. And if you've got a couple of them, now again, you can, depending on the team that you decide to get with. So then you mentioned, that you raise funds and raise capital. I mean, how are you reaching out to people? I mean, let's get into the differences. And again, we're not attorneys and we're not accountants. We understand the law and understand in part. So you need to go and make sure that you talk to your financial and legal providers. But 506C, 506B, you want to explain that to the people?
Yeah, real quickly. And again, I'm also not an attorney. All I'm doing is repeating back what I hear attorneys apply to me. And so you take this insight and this information, and then you go and test it against an attorney that you talk to so that
Exactly.
they're not having to educate you on everything.
There you
And
go.
so, just in broad strokes, basically the SEC is trying to protect the little guy from being screwed out of money from shysters. That's the principle. That's what they're there for. And if you're a non-accredited investor, we'll explain what that means in a second, but a non-accredited investor, meaning you don't have any special qualifications from a net worth or income level, then the SEC is really looking out for you. And you can only invest in what they call 506B, meaning you have up to 35 of these non-accredited investors into a 506B offering. And it's just some paperwork, 80-page private placement memorandum document that'll put you to sleep when you read it. And it basically says that this is what's being set up by the sponsor of the project, and they're looking to raise some capital, and you can invest into certain shares. And there's this long document that an attorney can explain to you sometime. And in the case of a 506C is for accredited investors. And accredited investors, with the current rules as this is being recorded, is that you have to have a net worth of $1 million, not including your personal residence or income for a single person of 200,000 or more, or a married couple of $300,000 or more for the last 2 years and projected to have that same this year. So a lot of details there. Or you can be a licensed person and be considered a credit investor. And so these are the current rules. There's some talk about having those changed and upped in the future, and that I think they'll probably pass. And so accredited investors will be a little harder to find in the foregoing in the coming years. But as it stands now, that's the rules. And so a credit investor, somebody has a net worth of $1 million, just to keep it simple, they can invest, or they can be marketed to openly from sponsors like us. And the distinction between us as sponsors is, can we openly market and talk about it? Or do we have to only talk to people that we have a material relationship with? That's the distinction. And so when you're looking to raise capital for one of your projects, and you got a property contract, and you decide to do a 506B with your attorney, you pay the five or 10, 12, $15,000 attorney fees to get it set up, then you can go and talk to people that you have an established relationship with, and they don't have to be credited. And that usually works pretty well for small to moderate sized projects. And as the projects get bigger, a lot of times it just doesn't make sense. Like if you're raising, $25 million, it just takes a lot of $100,000 checks to get there. So what people do is they end up going to accredited investors or institutional investors when they're raising capital.
So then, in terms of making sure that you have this, I think the SEC called it the pre-existing substantive relationship or material
Yeah.
relationship, as you mentioned.
Which is not defined in anywhere,
It was in a letter, I think, that the
right?
SEC put out. How do you track that? I mean, what is your process that, then says that you've established a relationship with this individual?
So advice that I was given from one of my attorneys, it says that you want to have three touches within at least 30 days time before you have them invest in any project. So if you've met, it's you and I have just now been met, and you and I very likely could do business in the future. And if I had a project to promote, I couldn't really come out to you and say, hey, I got this deal. Would you want to buy? You'd have to ask me. And you ask me about, hey, Paul, do you have any projects? And I was like, well, I have one, but we don't really know each other that well yet. Maybe you can look at it, but I'm not really offering that to you yet. And that might be an open way to talk about it. Always check these words with an attorney. We're going to say that for
Absolutely.
everything.
Absolutely. Please check with an attorney. I don't know. I've got to put this on a,
Flashing,
panel
because
out
I
there.
mean, we have to figure out how to operate and talk about this stuff, while also kind of staying within these like not that well-defined lines. And the cost of going outside those lines is very punitive. So you want to be really careful and cautious about this. And you hear people always give this disclaimer of, go and talk to your professional, go and talk to your doctor, all this kind of stuff, right? Because this stuff's complicated. And we don't know your personal situation and we're not qualified to give you advice. And so it's what we do on these podcasts is we're towing the line of talking generally about things and projects that we've worked on so that you can educate yourself, so that you can ask good questions and kind of get the best possible, understand the advice that's given to you later on.
Yeah.
That's the spirit behind these podcasts like this.
Yeah, we want you to make money, not lose money. And part
Yeah.
of that is making sure that you're educated. And sometimes talking to an attorney just cold and needing to be
With
educated.
no context, it's
Yeah.
expensive and you don't understand it.
You're spending some of the attorneys that I've talked to, $400 an hour, and you're like,
Right.
huh?
Yeah. So you want to get as much of the
Yeah.
foundation possible,
Yeah.
and you want to ask some shrewd questions, some informed questions to just make sure you understand. And then they can give you specific advice on what's happening on a deal you're actually working on.
There you go. Absolutely. Well, that's great, man. So then do you have like a CRM that you keep track of so that you know the dates and things of that sort?
That's
You want to
right.
give any CRMs that you like and like, love, and are passionate about?
Yeah, so we use a version of Go High Level for our it's a very common use now, and it's a growing profoundly. Ours is kind of a branded version of it that we offer to our clients, and we call it Commercial Investor Pro. And so clients that join our coaching program have access to an instance of Commercial Investor Pro, which is a white label version of Go High Level.
That's awesome. I just recently started looking at Go High Level as well. I'm looking at my CRM and thinking, I think I might need to switch. We'll see. So yeah,
I'll give you a prediction that within 6 months you're switching. We should do a
but
bet.
okay, we should do a bet, definitely. Why do you say that? Let me ask that question. Why do you
Yeah.
say that?
It's growing in popularity. It can do just about everything you want it to do, and it's very reasonably priced for the offering, and more people are using it, and so it's going to be to this point to where it's difficult to not be the one using it. It's like there are quicker and easier and probably much cheaper versions of QuickBooks, but everybody that is in the business uses QuickBooks. So it's just so much easier to speak in that parlance.
Gotcha. I understand. Well, in addition to QuickBooks, or in opposition to QuickBooks, there is another application that I use, Wave Apps, and it's totally free. It's an
What
online.
is Wave Apps?
See. Go check out Wave Apps. Wave Apps is like QuickBooks, but it is free. So that's something for somebody else if you're interested in using those things. Open source and free are my things. Okay, so then with respect to, you mentioned earlier in this conversation that interest rates have gone up. I think we were in a period of time there where interest rates went up about 11 times in a short period of time. And now they're kind of frozen, and there's talk about potentially cutting some rates. What are your thoughts right now about what the market is going to be, multifamily wise right now moving forward?
Yeah, good question. So I think a lot of us who have been in the space looking for multifamily, we just noticed that it was just really hard to make deals pencil out in 2023. And as we're in the early parts of 2024, the number of transactions are increasing. The amount of or the willingness of lenders has kind of smoothed out. They're much more agreeable now. They're not quite as cautious. Their interest rates have gone down quite a bit, even though they haven't lowered the interest rate, because banks like predictability, and the Fed has openly stated that they're not raising rates again. If anything, they have hinted at lowering rates, and that just gives everybody the sense that we found the bottom. And are, depending on how you look at it. Yeah,
Okay.
depending on how you look at it. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people feel that way. Whether it's true or
Okay.
not, we'll have to wait and see. But we found the bottom because the prevailing force that forced that kept everything in a weird state was this like precipitously high interest rates compared to where they were. And people didn't know what the rates were going to be. Whereas now we feel like we can do a forecast and get a reasonable sense of what our interest rates are going to be when we actually close on a deal. And so most of these projects are going to be locked in place for 3 to 5 years on these commercial loans. And so we have a forecast of expecting that our interest rates are still the same. And in the, 3, 5, 10 year horizon, we don't see anything that indicates that we're going to be at 18% interest or something like that, which is what people were worried about a couple just 6 to 12 months ago. Like, where is this ever going to stop? And the Fed has openly stated that they've stopped and they haven't raised rates now, I think, for 7 months.
Yeah, but there were a lot of people who went out in 2022, 2023, who were doing bridge loans, that are now coming due as well.
Right.
So I know
Nerve-wracking.
there's still some pain out there for some, you know, in terms of, you know, what does long-term debt look like? And so, you know, long-term in our, when you're doing deals, are you taking the 10-year money or are you taking the 5-year money? What are your thoughts?
In as many cases as possible, I'm trying to reduce interest rate risk, especially when we were in the environment where interest rates were actively rising. And so I was looking for recapitalization type projects where there was really low interest, fixed rate interest rates for a long time. So I was doing like agency debt kind of situations where the interest rates were like 4.25 and they were fixed for 40 years. And that just takes
Oh, so
the
you were doing the very, very long term. So you're buying and not selling at all, ever.
And those are penalties to those if you sell them too quickly. So these are like relatively long hold scenarios. Like, best case scenario, you're probably gonna not sell it for 5 years, which is typically the turnover pace for apartments anyway. So I just wasn't in a really big hurry to flip short term apartments. That's just not the business that I want to be in. There's a lot of work in there. There's a lot of money in it too, but there's a lot of work in it that I don't want to do.
Yeah, Jim, and for those that are listening, I'm understanding what you're saying, but part of my mind is going back saying, well, what about everybody else? Let's catch everybody else up. Generally, 3 to 5 years is what most people are in their apartment buildings for. Either
Right.
you're going to recapitalize by refinancing and
Yep.
returning
Or
that
selling.
equity or selling, right? Returning that money back to the investors or selling and returning it back. Depending on how some people do, they say, we want everybody in it forever. So they'll refinance and then return the money. But you're going to 40 years. That's that type of money. You're not selling at all. You're doing, I think there's one other investor I know that that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to do legacy building. So he's planning to have that asset for a long period of time. So
And you would
while
only do that on qualifying properties. So these are projects that have been built since 2015 or later, and they're typically Class A properties. And so these are like what they consider agency debt worthy projects, which are not everywhere you look. Like most of the value add play that most of us are getting into when first getting started, it are not these Class A minus deals in most cases. Like you're taking a Class C property and it's an 18 unit and it's and you got to do some value add to it. And then 3, 5, 7 years from down the road, you're going to sell it. And that's an appropriate thing to do in this phase of your beginning investment cycle.
So then at this point in time, the percentage of your portfolio that's Class A is about.
Most of it. But again, I'm owning like anywhere from 1 to 10% of that project. So I'm a minority owner in that. I'm not like there is a really good sponsor that found this deal and they needed partnerships to help kind of make the deal work. And then I would come in for a small percentage of that deal. And that's the kind of the role that I play.
And now I've seen 40-year debt on BC to be more or less, you know, those that may have built in an affordable housing option, if I'm not mistaken, those
That's right.
HUD type loans. And so that's why I initially thought you were talking about those, but that's not what you were saying. You were saying that 40-year note, if you will, on Class A type, correct?
I mean, it certainly, if you qualify for affordable housing requirements, then there are some amazing tax implications and there are some amazing loan products that are backed by the government agencies that really make those projects very compelling. I just don't necessarily like the potential appreciation play of B and C. Like the real wealth in real estate is in the appreciation of your assets, and there will be some appreciation on Class B and C assets, just not as much as I've seen in Class A. So there's less cash flow in Class A, but I'm not in the stage of life where I'm looking to maximize cash flow. I'm kind of in a comfortable place from a cash flow perspective, and I'm trying to get a hold of equity that I control in a project that doesn't require just a ton of my time.
Gotcha. So then let me ask this question as we're wrapping up here is about marketing, right? We're talking about marketing and going after and finding new people to, you know, because you're doing capital raising, right? What types of things? We talked about systems that we could use. We talked about systems that could be used for investor relations. What would one do right now if they were interested in you know, potentially, you know, starting to be a part of a team? And part of their responsibility is capital raising. How would they go out and find people?
Perfectly worded question. You've done your work, your homework, I can tell. So this is like the business that all of us are going to be into. If you stay in the business of real estate long enough, you're going to raise capital. And so he's asked the fundamental question of how do you start? And most people wait way too long to start developing the relationships that it takes to raise money. And there's this kind of notion that contacts equals contracts. And the difference being that the letter R, which is relationships,
That's
right? And
good.
so this is a Grant Cardone thing. He coined it. I didn't, but he's right. And there's a reason why he has $4 billion of assets under management, and he's really good at making relationships. So he says. I don't know. He's a good marketer for sure. And so people know who he is. And so you need to do the same thing. People need to know who you are and have a relationship with you. So the way to start is, I'll take this from another author, Adam Carroll. He has this concept called the Power 100. You familiar?
I think I've
And
heard of Adam. But go
yeah,
ahead,
he wrote a
please
really
let
good
me know.
book. Yeah, and he has a chapter called his Power 100. And he actually has an acronym for what power stands for. I forget what it is. But basically, it's the people that already know who you are and that you know them. People that you could text, you could email, you could make a phone call, and they would actually answer and say, "Hey, Jonathan, nice to hear from you. Well, what's up?" And those are your people. Whether it's 50, 100, 150, you have those people in your contacts right now. You just don't really think about it that way. And so the story, the lesson here is start working those relationships and tell them, "Hey, I'm getting into commercial real estate. I'm really excited about buying a new apartment complex. If and when I ever come across a deal, would you like to hear more about it?"
There you go.
So
That makes
I'm not raising any money. I'm
right.
raising relationships. I'm establishing
Exactly.
it. I'm planting a seed that in the future, if I come across a new deal, that comes across my desk, I think it's a good one, would you want to hear more about it? That's completely compliant with everything that an attorney, I've run that script through several attorneys and I said, that's perfectly fine because you already know these people and you're not promoting a specific deal.
There you go. And you don't want to promote a specific deal. So, and I will give you this story. I had several years ago, I looked at my email list and my database. This was before I got into commercial. And I said, I had about 10,000 people in the list. And I
Oh,
was
good.
like, who are these people? You know what I mean? I was like, where, now they had been either emails that had come or whatever. And I said, well, let me go and dedupe. I got
Right.
down to 7,000,
Sure.
right? So then I was just like, this is still too much. I don't know who,
It's not
and so then
manageable, right?
I started going for the relationship triangle people talk about, right?
Yep.
Know me, like me, trust me, right? Know
Yep.
me, like me, trust me. Those three things. If you got those, then you can reduce that even more. And then, like you said, start building those relationships. Now, how do you like to build those relationships? Are you calling them? Are you email blasting them? What kind
Yes,
of
yes, and
touches are
yes.
you doing?
Yes,
Yes,
yes, and
yes, and
yes.
yes.
So I have a newsletter. I have a list just like you do. I have a newsletter to where I send out updates. I have a podcast just like you do. I have a blog that I put out there. And anybody who's out here can very easily create a list of about 100 people and just start doing a monthly newsletter saying, here's what's new with me. Call it whatever you like. Don't make it a big deal. I'm looking at commercial real estate and just talk, I mean, a paragraph or two and just leave it at that. That person
Paragraph
is
or two,
now,
please.
yeah,
Yes.
that person is now in your world. And they're like kind of curious about what's happening with you. And then every so often you do a call to action, say, hey, if you would like to get together and talk shop, here's my Calendly link. I'd love to talk shop with you for about 15 minutes. One in 100 people will actually do that, but you've established it. And then you go through and take your phone and you text people. Like you go through your contacts and you create your Power 100 and you manually text people and say, hey, how's life? I heard your younger brother just got accepted into the medical program or something. That's super cool. I knew you guys way back from high school. I'm so excited about what's going on. What else has happened in your life? And here's the magic. Whatever the conversation that you have about them, you add it to your notes section of your phone. And you keep a database of
Yes.
everybody you talk to, every relationship and keep those details. And they give you an update. Yeah, I want my daughter, she's 6 years old now and she just started kindergarten. And we were really, and they'll tell you something. Put that into your notes. The next time you talk to them, you ask about their daughter. I heard she went to kindergarten last year. You know, how old is she now? She probably what second grade by now? How's elementary school going for? Like, people really appreciate that. And all you're doing is taking notes so that you remind yourself in the future what to tell, talk to people about them.
And one of the things that I used to have, and it was just in my database. I don't know how it got there initially. This was years ago. I have not done it. I'm a bad person, and I have not followed up with it. So that's on me, is that I would have a lot of people's birthdays. And so there was a free online e-card that I could send people. And so when it would come up on my calendar, oh, it's so-and-so's birthday, I would literally just copy there, whatever. Go to the generic free e-card, paste that in there, and people just knew. Jonathan, remember, I was waiting on Jonathan's e-card. And I'm like, you were waiting? They're like, no, I was waiting on your e-card. I know you're going to send me something and you're going to reach out to me.
What was
So,
really cool is most people put their, not most, but a lot of people put their birth date, not year, but birth date
yeah.
in Facebook. So go and mine that, put that into your deal, and there you go.
There you
And
go.
make it a habit of capturing. I used to do this too, and I kind of fell off myself because you get busy. But if you're getting started and you're trying to kind of like an easy lift, how hard is it to reach out to somebody and say happy birthday? Because it's somebody's birthday every day. So do that for a while with your list.
And you would be surprised that a lot of people, would be, very happy to receive some sort of at least just an acknowledgement of their birthday. You don't have to really do very much
Yeah, you
in
were
that
thinking
way.
about them that day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, man, this has been very good, Paul. How can people get in contact with you and learn more about you, learn more about how they can potentially get on your list for your next set of projects that's coming up?
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of us is going to our website at realestate101.com. It's spelled about the way you'd expect, realestate101.com. And if you're looking for me personally, you can find me at most any social platform at Paul David Thompson.
There you go. And so we have one last question that we ask every guest that comes on here. We want everybody to get the boot. So it is that one piece of advice, if you will, one piece of encouragement, whatever it is that spurs people on to do the next best thing for them in their career. What is that piece of advice for us, Paul?
Okay, that piece of advice right now is based on something you've heard today. A little inkling went off in your head. And it's like, oh, I really should do that. Oh, and there's one thing that kind of resonated with you. And it's gonna be different for everybody who's listening. But right now, you're the one person I'm talking to, and you're like, you know what? I really should start doing the birthday thing, or I really start should do start. I should find an attorney, or I should really start making some more offers. Whatever that thing is that hits you, something specific. That's the boot, you know, what I call is the wake-up call. And I love your idea of this, like you need to just like a real solid kick in the ass sometimes.
There you go.
And this was what this conversation was about. You came on here to learn something and you got a little idea. Now, the difference between knowledge and results is action.
There you go. Thank you again, Paul, for your time, and looking forward to encountering a path crossing again very soon in the future. Thank you
Likewise, looking
again.
forward to it.
All right.